When you hear the two words science laboratory, what comes to mind? Probably something a little quieter than this.
What's the color check?
Especially if the lab is called Vanderbilt's Research on Individuals, Politics, and Society Lab, part of Vanderbilt's Department of Political Science. Recently, I spoke with co-directors Cindy Kam and Elizabeth Seckmeister. Why is it important for Vanderbilt to have a lab for political science research, and how unusual is this? Cindy?
It's important because I think that experiments in political science are the sort of new wave in how we're conducting systematic research on individuals, how people make decisions about politics. So experiments give us an opportunity to test causal questions in ways that people might not be able to articulate on their own. For example, if we want to know the extent to which gender matters in people's decisions about politics, you could go ahead and ask them. But people aren't necessarily fully aware of how they feel about gender, or they might not want to admit it, or it might be more complicated than that. And experiments give us an opportunity to test very cleanly the role of, say, sex of a candidate or the race of a candidate by manipulating the stimuli that are presented to people without them fully knowing that they're being experimented on.
Are you saying that this actually makes political research an actual science? In other words, we're actually getting results.
We are a social science, so we can conduct controlled experiments where one group of people is randomly assigned to receive some set of stimuli and another group of people is randomly assigned to receive another set of stimuli. For example, two groups of people, one might be asked to read an article about two candidates, one who is female and one who is male. Another set of people might be asked to read an article about two candidates, both of whom are male. By manipulating simply the gender or the name of a candidate, then we can see the effect of the sex of a candidate without asking people to directly say whether or not sex of a candidate makes a difference to them. And in terms of how unusual it is, I would say experiments are up and coming in political science research. They've been mainstream, I think, for only the last 5 to 10 years, and only, I would say, less than 15 to 20 universities in the country have a political science research laboratory. So in that sense, Vanderbilt, I think, is on the cutting edge, and we're getting asked to provide advice on how to set up research labs in political science departments in other places such as MIT, University of Kentucky, Pittsburgh, et cetera.
Liz, what does the political science lab at Vanderbilt look like?
It's sort of an unusual lab, typical in some ways and then atypical in others. It's 10 stations, 10 computer stations, separated into individual carrels that all appear uniform so that no matter which station you're seated at, you get the sort of the same experience. But the unusual aspect of our lab is that rather than having desktop systems, computers sitting there, we actually have laptops that are docked. So one of the neat things about the lab is that we can have it be stationary in the lab or we can take it anywhere. So we could, for example, take it to the farmer's market and set up a station there and ask people to come participate in a study. Or we can take it further afield. So we can take it, for example, to another country. We have carrying cases. We can take the lab to Mexico. We can take the lab to Bolivia, to Ecuador. And these are actually things that we have in plan for the next couple of years with the lab.
Have you taken the computer anyplace yet out in the field?
We have not done that yet. Cindy and I have both done experiments in the field, but we've used other means.
Yeah, so one thing I wanted to add was that experimental research in political science has been done for a while using pencil and paper. And that's fine, but it can be sort of cumbersome and it also makes it hard to do things on the fly or even to, say, show people political campaign advertisements. You can't do that if you only have a paper and pencil survey. So what we've done with the computers is really been able to sort of tech up the kinds of stimuli that we provide people, which makes it more realistic, you know, more like what they encounter in their ordinary lives when it comes to politics.
It also saves us hours in terms of data entry that we would be doing if we conducted the test using paper and pencil. We then have to have research assistants enter the data, which takes a lot of time and can introduce new errors. So if we have people actually take the study on the computer and we transfer that data into a statistical package to analyze, then we eliminate the cost and the errors that we might potentially introduce.
So what type of projects have you done so far?
We ran several studies this past year. So in the fall of 2008, we spend a lot of time setting up the lab. And then we ran a study. We had 350 or so undergraduates come into the lab. We recruited in 7 different classes. And we ran a study that had several components, one of which was to look at leadership evaluations in the context of the 2008 presidential election.
So
we are looking at how people evaluated the candidate's leadership potential. There's a standard question that's used in the American National Election Study Survey and elsewhere that asks people to, with respect to a given person, comment on the extent to which they think that person is a strong leader. And so one of the things that we were doing in the lab was looking at how different contexts that we presented to the subjects affected the evaluations they gave to the various candidates in the 2008 race.
Was this before the election?
Mm-hmm. This was before the election. Although an interesting thing about Tennessee, since we're new here, we're finding out new things about Tennessee, is that early voting is not only something that people can do, but is something that has become increasingly popular. So we had to ask a question about whether or not people had already voted in a certain portion of our subjects had already voted. So when we analyzed the data and when we're interested in vote choice, we screened those people out of the data set.
Could you share any of the results from that?
Well, this was a follow-up study to some work that I've been doing on the effects of various types of threats on people's evaluations of political leaders. And the expectation is that in times of security threat, in particular the threat of a terrorist attack, people will evaluate certain leaders as stronger and more capable than they would otherwise. The background argument in theory is that people are looking for some type of a hero, a savior in times of crisis. So if you make a crisis salient, they elevate certain leaders' traits, right? So what we did was we gave one group of student subjects an article that played up the threat of a terrorist attack, and another group of subjects an article that, instead of mentioning threat, talked about good times in the United States. So tried to present the opposite type of context. And then we compared evaluations of leadership across those two groups, and as well the weight that people accorded those evaluations in their vote choice determination. So one of the analyses that we've done so far with those data is to look at whether or not people who were in the terrorist threat scenario weighted strong leadership more in their vote choice for the 2008 presidential election than those who were in the good times. And our data are consistent with 2 previous studies that we've done where we find that this is indeed the case. So that in times of terrorist threat, people put a greater emphasis, put more weight on strong leadership as an important characteristic determining their vote choice than they do under this sort of good time scenario.
And so did that impact their choice of whether they would vote for Barack Obama or John McCain?
We actually didn't look at how it affected the specific choice that they made. What we were interested in, if you think of vote choice, someone's vote choice is being determined by a number of different ingredients, policy positions, past performances, as well as candidate traits. And within the bundle of candidate traits, there are a number of different traits that might be important, like honesty, morality, and also strong leadership. We were interested in whether or not the connection between strong leadership and someone's choice became stronger under that threat condition, so that in times of terrorist threat, do people prioritize strong leadership when they're making that choice? And that's what we've found evidence for.
Are you doing any research this summer?
We are doing some research this summer. I'll let Cindy talk about it.
Okay. We are joining forces with the psychology department. Sohee Park, who is a psychology professor, as well as John Gere and Efren Perez, who are both professors in the political science department. So the 5 of us are interested in looking at the effect of negative ads or positive ads on people's political evaluations. So our colleague John Gere has written a lot about negative ads, but he hasn't written so much about the psychological foundations of what happens when people are exposed to negative or positive ads. And so because we're working with a psychologist and because both Liz and I are political psychologists, we have more of an insight into how to think about what goes on in people's minds when they hear a negative or a positive ad. So one of the things that we're sort of considering is whether a negative ad is powerful because it contains specific information or because it evokes strong emotional sort of negative reactions. And so we're hopefully going to be able to determine that. And our plan is to pilot this, that is, conduct an initial test of this this summer and then run the study on campus staff and employees in the fall.
And what will be Zoe Park's role in this?
Well, Zoe Park, the psychologist, has been in the planning stage for the entire process. So she's someone who studies vision and decision-making. And so what we're hoping to do, and of course has a lot of expertise in psychological instruments and measures. She's been instrumental in helping us develop our hypotheses, our approach for this the problem, and also in helping us think about how the psychological processes might work. She's also brought in some psychological measures that they use typically in the field of psychology. Since we're political psychologists, we're very familiar with what political scientists do, but not so familiar with what psychologists do. So it's useful to have the expertise of someone in that field, too. Finally, I think some of us are interested in exploring physiological measures, that is, things like galvanic skin response, sort of measuring people's sense of arousal or stress. And we're hoping to use one of her machines to see the extent to which a negative or a positive ad evokes sort of stress or anxiety or some physiological changes in people. And since and her expertise is going to be invaluable in that.
I was wondering, yes, if there'd be a way that you might start looking at their brains for some type of MRI.
There is a very small body of political science research that is doing this sort of neurocognitive stuff with the MRI imaging. That is not something that I personally prioritize because there is a lot of startup cost in doing that. But this is an opportunity, I think, for us to work with Sohi, and Sohi might be able to connect us with people in the imaging center, and we'd be able to capitalize on their expertise. So we wouldn't have to necessarily learn how to do imaging, but we could provide some political science background and help develop hypotheses that would be relevant for political science.
So this is why political science is crossing over to some other disciplines, psychology, and perhaps even other departments.
I would say so. Political science, I think, it has been working with psychology and also economics departments quite a bit. The link to neuroscience is rather new, I'd say, in the last 5 to 10 years, maybe. But political scientists who do that are interested in things like what happens in the brain when people are exposed to threatening stimuli. That is, if a diehard Democrat is exposed to a picture of Rush Limbaugh or a picture of some other prominent, you know, sort of conservative figure, does a certain center in the brain, say the amygdala, which is the sort of threat locus, does that light up? That's something that political scientists are starting to do.
Or perhaps a Republican seeing a picture of one of the Kennedys.
Exactly.
Someone very
exactly.
liberal.
Exactly. Or people might be interested in what happens when individuals, a white individual, is exposed to a set of photographs with black people in them in stereotypical or non-stereotypical, you know, sort of poses. Say, what happens in the brain when people are exposed to, you know, basically political stimuli? That's important to us, I think, because to some extent we're interested in what's controllable and what's uncontrollable. So if things happen in our brains and we're not motivated to control our responses, if, you know, the threat center lights up, then people might say, okay, I'm threatened, I'm going to say no to that policy, if they're not motivated to sort of say put the brakes on and say, let me think about this.
Will their lab be mostly used for people at Vanderbilt, or would it be open to the community?
I think the lab, the hypotheses and causal tests that will be conducted will be by Vanderbilt people, but not just political science. So, for example, we're working with the psychology department now, so we're able to sort of bridge across different schools and different departments to conduct systematic research on individual-level decision-making. We don't necessarily think that we'll be sort of hired out by community groups or anything. But if there is a community group that would be interested in exploring something about political decision-making that we find interesting, we may be able to join forces with them.
Will there be students working in the lab?
Mm-hmm. We have students already working in the lab. So one of the things that makes, I think, the lab a really useful thing for Vanderbilt to have, just going back to your first question, why is it important for Vanderbilt to set up a lab like this, is not only because it allows us to do cutting-edge research and makes us a cutting-edge institution in that way, but also because it serves a really important pedagogical purpose. So we really prioritize getting students involved in the lab at both the undergraduate and the graduate levels. At the undergraduate levels, we recruit them in as research assistants. So this past year, we had a number of undergraduate students work as research assistants in the lab. They come in, they're trained, they become certified to work with human subjects. They then are in charge of implementing the studies. We also have graduate students who work as research assistants, and we have graduate students who are putting their own studies into experiments in the lab. So this past spring, we had a graduate student put his own study onto one of the omnibus studies that was held in the lab, and we plan to do more of that this coming year.
Do the students earn any compensation?
The undergraduate students are paid, and the graduate students are typically paid, or they're doing it as part of another research assistantship for which they're being paid. If they're putting their own studies on, then they are getting the benefit of collecting their own data. We usually ask them to put in some man hours then to sort of help out with the studies, since we're all putting in hours programming, organizing the schedule, recruiting subjects. We tend another pedagogical aspect of the lab is that after we do a study, we ask the professors and instructors from the classes that we recruited if they'd like us to come back and talk to their students about the studies that we've done. So one of the other sort of work components is going back to these classrooms and giving a presentation that explains the purpose of the lab, the benefits of doing this type of research, the type of study that they contributed to, and what the sort of future of that study is, so that they don't end up having an experience that sort of begins and ends with their, you know, half hour at the computer.
How will the lab be used in the recruitment of new faculty, do you think? Are the people that are coming in the fall, will they be using the lab?
I don't know that the new faculty we have coming on board will jump right into the lab, but I think we can probably lure them into the lab. We've been pretty successful at our previous institution. We had a lab, and we made a lot of effort to reach out and draw different types of faculty into research projects in the lab. So once you have a lab set up and you show people how easy it is to test a causal hypothesis, people sort of come out of the woodwork realizing, you know, well, I have this idea and I never thought of actually testing it in a lab, but now I'm seeing how I could do it. And I think we've already begun to see stirrings of that in the department. Currently, I imagine that will continue and that involvement will increase over the years.
And I think one of the nice things about the lab is that it is a locus for bringing people together into collaborative research endeavors, not only just faculty, but also faculty with graduate students. And so our experience here and our experience at our previous institution suggests that you can have the computers there, that's one thing, but it's really sort of the human capital that makes a difference, that it's very exciting to be in an environment where groups of faculty come together and say, hey, that's a really cool idea. Let's work together to explore the political implications of this possible idea, and we can do that inside our department as well as, you know, bridging sort of across different departments. And I think that's certainly something that is attractive to potential people that we could recruit here, and it's certainly important for retention as well.
So instead of people just reading information out of a book and sort of a survey type of research, this is people actually meeting and talking and exchanging ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And feeding off each other's expertise.
And it is also a contrast to the standard political science study, which is take some off-the-shelf data, analyze it the best you can to fit your particular research question, even if that study or survey wasn't originally done, you know, with your intentions in mind, right? So some of this is the standard sort of political science study does its best with existing data. What the lab does is say you don't have to satisfy us. You can design the study that's perfect for the kind of question that you want to ask.
Can people visit the lab if they would like to see what it looks like?
Sure. We actually have a website, and we can give you that link, and that has pictures of the lab on it.
It's the Research on Individuals, Politics, and Society Lab. Our direct link is www.vanderbilt.edu/RIPS, Research on Individuals, Politics, and Society.
We've been talking with Cindy Kam, Associate Professor of Political Science, and Elizabeth Zechmeister, Assistant Professor of Political Science. Kam and Zechmeister are co-directors of the Research on Individuals, Politics, and Society Lab at Vanderbilt. For Interview, I'm Avery Dear Owens.